The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, Bill talks about the big bucks. John details the duty to protect. Maria gets into interdiction. Jennifer takes on philosophy and AI. More fraud, spies, and lies, a pitch you will not believe, it's true, and much more, only on The Cyber Show. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
August 8th is our annual Go to Angel free-for-all. Any startup can pitch for free and get a 30-second slot on the Cyber Show. You have to fill out a G-Wiz before you can record, and you have to show up live online remote for the event in order to get on the radio show. To sign up, click on the link at thecybershow.co. This segment's called The Pitch. In The Pitch, a company presents in the hopes that you, the listening audience, will find them interesting enough to go the next step.
Hi, everybody, and a very pleasant Wednesday to you, wherever you may be.
Sandy into his windup. Here's The Pitch.
Executive Cyber Events is an OI5, angel to exit startup. Its focus is quarterly events around the world to inform, educate, and promote cybersecurity. It does this by providing a high-quality, forward-looking, entertaining venue with top talent and outstanding information supported by ongoing activities and presence in the market. It earns its keep through sponsorships, booths at shows, add-on workshops, and recurring revenue from online advisory and analyst content, forums, and similar membership activities. A core value is that learning and participation should be fun, and to do this, we include emotional as well as logical components with personality. It has funding in place for the first 3 months of startup operations. It has strong intellectual property, adequate operational capacity for emergence, and proper governance and legal status for this phase of growth. If you are interested in participation, please get in touch.
And this week we have a twofer.
National Security Training Institute is an OI5, angel to exit startup. Its focus is the education of technical issues related to national security. This includes the full range of operational issues such as nuclear, chemical, biological, and cyber warfare offense and defense, intelligence and influence operations, critical infrastructure protection, environmental and other trans-border issues, all aspects of technical security, governance structures that support or impede operations, and the underlying human and machine interdependencies. Everything but the politics and international relations issues. It has funding in place for the first 3 months of startup operations. It has strong intellectual property, adequate operational capacity for emergence, and proper governance and legal status for this phase of growth. If you are interested in participation, please get in touch.
Matlack on the 0-1. Bowdy hits a drive into the gap in the left center field. There she is. Papers flying, everybody standing.
For more details on this pitch and to view their G-Wiz, go to thecybershow.co and click on their listing.
That was absolutely amazing.
Breaking news on The Cyber Show. The three hottest months in history have just been recorded along with massive flooding and tornadoes. Thus, the cyber-based predictions of climate change appear to be coming true. However, there is hope. Climate change deniers are now claiming it's all being caused by the results of the computer analysis and reporting. As a result, they're trying to shut down further analysis and reporting. And that's breaking news on The Cyber Show.
We're discussing the history of the cyber world with Bill Murray. This is not the Bill Murray, the actor. This is William H. Murray, the well-known, globally respected cybersecurity person who has been working in this field for many, many years.
The security of a mechanism is completely and totally dependent upon the application and the environment. that nothing useful can be said about security except in the context of a specific application and a specific environment. And part of the environment, of course, is the threat level.
And part of the environment is the use.
No, that's application. Application on the one hand, environment on the other.
Thank you for differentiating the two. The point is that nothing general purpose.
So I want to limit purpose.
When you say limit purpose, what application do you have that limits the purpose?
Oh, the application that I use to do my banking. It's only useful for banking. I can't use it for anything else.
I'm sorry, you say you can't use it for anything else, but what is the, when you say banking, that's not a well-defined purpose. You use it to buy toys. You use it to buy cars.
No, I don't. I don't use it for any of those things. I use it to manage my Fidelity account, and I can only use it with Fidelity. Now I can.
Okay.
I
can put my can you generate a check from that Fidelity account?
I can. I do not, but I can.
You can. Okay. So what you're saying is you're using it for a limited subset of the things that can be used for, and that increases your safety.
Every time I limit application, I increase my safety.
The word secure is not a relative term. It's a meaningless term because it expresses an absolute, and there is no such thing.
I can say things about security in the context of an application and an environment that I cannot say absent those two things.
I agree with you. But my argument is with the notion of this secure thing, this perfection objective that people keep, you know, sticking out there as a word. The reality is, you know, we can bring things to a reasonable level of trust. That is, we can have a reasonable basis to trust them. That is, we're willing to lose this much based on our belief in that thing.
We call that risk management.
Yes, we do.
And even most of the security professionals are not good at it.
Well, I find most security professionals don't know what the R word means. You know, that four-letter word that ends in K, risk. So when I ask them for what you mean when you say risk, most of them can't answer the question.
Well, and one of the tests that I use for a security professional is somebody who can use threat, attack, vulnerability, consequence, and risk in a consistent and mutually exclusive way.
And few can pass the test.
Will,
I'm going to ask you, for the radio audience with no preparation, give me a very brief, simple definition of the term risk.
I can give you a model. The model is threat times...
I know the model, but that's not a definition. So I'm going to give you a definition, the one I commonly use, which is uncertainty about the future.
Okay, I can live with that.
And in that context...
But to manage things, I have to make assumptions.
Hang on. Let me continue, because when we talk about uncertainty about the future, when you talk about risk management, the uncertainty is not just about bad things that can happen. It's also about good things that can happen. So when we manage risk, we take risks for rewards. You use your software on your system so you can do that banking because it has a reward that you don't have to walk down to some physical place and interact with a human being to do the same thing. So you're taking the risk, that is the uncertainty about the future with regard to that application in terms of the bad things that can happen. And part of that risk is the reward of the bad things that don't happen from you walking down to the bank and getting hit by a car. Right. Or all the other things that can happen.
And it's the balance of those that we call risk management.
Absolutely. So this is something that's hard for people to understand. I find very few people in cybersecurity understand that in the context of the enterprise they work in.
Or even the things they do in their personal life.
I think everybody in their personal life recognizes that when they're going to walk across the street, they could be hit by a car. It's not that they don't recognize it. It's that their brain automatically takes it into account. Some people are risk averse and some people are risk takers. But that's how they manage their risk.
Agreed.
But when it comes to cyber, when it comes to so-called professionals,
They don't seem to get it. They always want to say, oh, get rid of the problems. Get rid of all the possible bad things that can happen. Whereas the people running the business are saying, you know, I can spend $1,000, you know, making it so that thing can't happen. But there's a lot of other things that could happen, like we don't sell enough of these things. So I'd rather spend the money on more sales than on more security, because the sales generate more money. And, you know, the security doesn't give me any value I can see.
Ah, yes, but it does, you see. Everything that we're asked to do in security has one of two effects. It either reduces the cost of the security measures or it reduces the cost of losses. Both of those things.
Or it increases the cost of the security measures and it increased the loss. So every decision you make could be positive or negative. The issue is.
And that's why I get paid the big bucks.
Exactly. That's why it takes expertise.
Right.
And there aren't enough experts in the world.
And that's why I get paid the big bucks.
If that were only true.
How do we know we're being successful at the Cyber Show? Well, here are the five ways we know today. One, we know the bad guys are listening because we get updated versions of our spam emails addressing the problems we found on the previous versions. Two, we know the broader listening audience is paying attention because they've complained about our use of terminology that should not appear on broadcast radio. Three, we know the startups are listening because we get contacts from startups looking for assistance in funding and growth. Four, we know the cybersecurity crowd is listening because they contact us on LinkedIn using email and other forms to tell us what they really think about what we say. And five, we know the elites are listening because they say, Dr. Fred Cohen, we're listening. If you want to tell us what you think, you can email us by going to thecybershow.co. If you have questions, email those questions, and we'd be happy to provide on-air answers. The Cyber Show, only on KMBY 1240 AM. We're listening. Frauds, Spies, and Lies, and How to Defeat Them. It's the name of a book, and now it's the name of a segment on our show. Here's a quickie list of current scam subject lines, my commentary included for your listening pleasure. Your payment letter is attached. Sure it is. Read donation code 0043043. Darn, I have code 0043044, so it must not be me. Did you receive your package? What package? MD called lower your glycemia in 4.2 seconds. Oh, yeah, what? Cut off your arm or something? Give me a break. Common bedtime habit skyrocks dementia. Okay, this has nothing to do with sex, just letting you know. What tomatoes do to your joints? Yes, they turn them red, but you can still smoke them if you let them dry out. My good friend, more like my bad enemy. Purple Power, weight loss magic. We will make these pounds sterling disappear. Ray-Ban sunglasses, 90% off. 2023 styling, free shipping, blah, blah, blah. Order now. Yeah, make it 100% off and I still won't buy it from you. If you see these or anything like them, don't click on them. Just mark them as spam and move on. One of the newest frauds on the internet today is a multi-step process. It starts with an initial contact offering something you want or need for your job. Then as you start to communicate, you get a link or a file emailed to you, chatted to you, texted to you, or connected to you through a social media application. When you open this file or click on the link, it displays a message indicating that it was corrupted and could not be opened. But in reality, it contains malicious code that merely displays that message and leaves a Trojan horse on your computer. Once that Trojan horse is in place, the attacker is in your system and expands their access to perform any of a number of malicious acts, typically ranging from extortion, this is often in the form of ransomware, to financial theft, for example, by altering banking information on an invoice. What can you do about it? Well, there's nothing much you can really do to prevent this sort of deception from working. The reason is that if you don't use the internet to get in touch with people in order to get your job done, you're likely not to be able to get the job done. But when you encounter the situation, you can recognize this scenario. And if you do, you can immediately contact whoever's in charge of cybersecurity and have them fix the problem before it gets worse. In the meanwhile, try and be safe out there, but don't imagine you're going to be perfect against modern threats. The cyber world touches deeply on and closely aligns with progress in the intelligence and counterintelligence fields. Nowhere is that more clear than in the discussions with John Tippett, who helps to put the cyber world in the context of national security.
You're doing all these work on these commissions, and we haven't even gotten to the Moynihan Commission yet.
Yep.
and you're testifying and you're doing, and then there's all this the classified commissions, which you could, I guess, generically tell us about, but I assume it's all in the same general space. It's all about security on a national basis and how you protect how you provide for the common defense, I guess, is the right way to talk about it, right?
Well, the commissions of that time frame, so from basically the 90s and 80s, 70s, you know, those commissions were basically focused on two questions. Question number one was prefaced by, we have too much classified information. Question number two was prefaced, we're wasting tons of money on vetting. And so those were the two guerrillas. Virtually in every one of these commissions, those were the two guerrillas in the meeting.
And now that drives us into the work that we did for the Department of Energy stuff, yep. Which was just a microcosm example of that, right?
Right. And we found some of the same problems.
Right. So that was a case. My recollection is, you know, probably not as good as yours of the details, but basically, the duty to protect was not understood. So they were just doing all sorts of things on an individual basis to decide, you know, whether somebody should have access based on who knows what, instead of following the strict set of rules that were actually the basis in law. And so ultimately what happened was it got traced back from the authorities to define the duty to protect. And then you tell the people, here's your duty, here's how you do your duty, and then they did their duty. And that went from the Department of Energy not being able to accomplish its mission to what I understand is a dramatic reduction in cost and improvement in efficiency and the ability to get the job done. Is that basically right?
Yeah, and they had made the same mistake as many agencies made. They had basically compartmentalized authorities to the extent that if you had all of them in a room and you said, who's in charge of information security, they would have all put their hands up. They would have all put their hands up and said, well, I'm in charge of information security in my pipeline. Okay. Well, you know, so, or something similar to that. Well, it's hard to make a decision when you're not using the principles or the guidelines or the rules that are published, right? So now there's two different things. You can apply the rules that are published and still not do the best job possible. But if you don't apply the rules that are published and the problems persist, then you take on a personal liability for not following the rules.
This is the same problem if somebody at the company starts escorting people to the parking lot after dark. Then you've created a duty to escort. And if you stop doing it or you don't do it for one person and something happens to them, then you're liable because you've created a duty.
Well, that's not entirely true. If you follow a reduction protocol that has been defined in many court cases that says if you take as much time as you took to communicate that protective procedure that then allowed employees or encouraged the employees to believe that that protective architecture existed, then you have a duty to do it. So you have to reverse that. You have to put in a program that disestablishes that protective architecture and convinces the affected group of people that you can no longer rely on that. And that same legal principle is what's getting a lot of law enforcement pushback by governance status even still today, because you know, everyone knows the reality that you can't put a cop in every corner. We can't afford it.
Right.
And we probably don't need it. But
yeah, we certainly don't want a police state.
Right. Right. So, and security faces in many aspects faces that same issue. I remember testifying before the commission on this business Monahan's original commission was to do away with background investigations initially, hire a person, give them access, moderate access, and then after their probationary period, run a background check on them. And so when I commented to that commission on that particular, I said, okay, put yourself in the position as a government official, elected, appointed, bribed into taking the office, I don't care. And you now are faced with an issue where someone, some mission has been compromised, and several, and there were losses that were sustained. I said, you're facing the question. You say in your manuals that you do this, 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 and this, and this, and this. What we find out is that you don't do this, 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 and this, and this. And oh, by the way, court has ruled that's a causative factor. And so guess what? You're liable. And the jury will decide how liable. But so duty to protect, remember, in the information security world, principally existed in something we called a non-disclosure agreement. That was essential duty. That was how you documented a duty to protect. Again, up front, I couldn't think of a better way of doing it. But
there are other duties besides non-disclosure, right? So, for example, in our standard agreements, you know, we say you have a responsibility to inform us of things that might cause functions to fail, right? So availability is another aspect. Transparency. So there are all these other facets that non-disclosure ignores.
Well, it's not just the non-disclosure, because what happens is over time, and this is true in the classified world, you sign an SF-312, which is the National Security Non-Disclosure Agreement. But what happened was, you notice, for an example, today we no longer submit the 312 to the government like we used to have to. The courts have found in lots of cases that you expect a person who's been in the business 25 years to remember what that non-disclosure agreement says.
No, not a chance.
So it has become, I mean, we still do them. You can't get access unless you've signed one and it's in the database. But the provisions of that, that's one of the reasons I get chastised for this every once in a while, but not so much lately. But I used to get chastised because I required, when a person processed out and we terminated their clearance, I gave them a copy of the SF-312 that they
they find. Yeah. Remember, these are your obligations. They remain your obligations.
And so no one could ever come back and say, well, gee, I never saw that after I signed it. Yeah. So, I mean, they could still say that, but I had documented evidence.
Okay. So among the wonderful things you hear out of John's mouth is the disestablishment of a policy. And of course, one of the complications is, you know, once people understand it, they're going to become just, they're going to focus on disestablishment as an activity. So they're going to become, you know, disestablishmentarians. And I'm personally anti-disestablishmentarianism.
Right. You know, I key on something that John said, you know, we forget what we signed, right? You know, and this is right in my world these days. This is where the whole DBOM thing, you know, automate our agreements. because, you know, the IP control. I mean, we're talking about liability here and information protection. Intellectual property is protected by hope around the world, right? You kind of hope that the people you hired remember what you said in the details of the contract that they signed, and that they know all of the details of all the contracts you have signed with all the other parties in their daily activity, and they don't say or share something that you deem to be intellectual property. How do you actually know that? You don't.
Well, you can't know what's in people's brains or what they do all the time without that surveillance state, right? So, but the other side of it is, I don't think it's really intended to protect against, you know, you accidentally telling your wife something that Fred said during call today. You know, I think right. The intent is that if it produces a consequence, right? So we talk about trade secrets, right? The consequence of revealing a trade secret can be $100 million plus, as in the Coca-Cola case, right? So here you have somebody that was not just, oh, accidentally telling somebody, not it wasn't a result of elicitation. You know, she was seeking out ways to sell it, right? She wanted to turn it into her own pocketbook. So I think that perfect systems, of course, can never exist. And, you know, so I think that's sort of the fundamental issue of all this stuff, right? We create these duties and we mean them to be enforced, and we remind people there's training, there's awareness programs to remind them. And it's a big deal today, right? For the anti-phishing and, you know, what's it called? Ransomware stuff that, oh, somebody made a mistake and this thing got in and now we're all messed up, right?
Right.
But people make mistakes. There's no way to avoid that people make mistakes.
Well, I look at this from two different opposite directions. The one is that, you know, for a lot of things, we need to automate this. And I think we have systems, you know, ways to do that that will be better. The other one is that we need to worry about the right things. You know, people actually, you know, I make that point about intellectual property and being protected by hope. But the hope is usually pretty well founded. Right. You know, most people will generally do their best to try not to, you know, breach, you know, their responsibilities and whatnot. And it works generally well. But when we turn to, you know, that fear of information sharing, it's like, oh, my God, I can't share intellectual property. The risk is unacceptable. It's like you do it all the time. Your controls aren't that great and you survive this long.
So let's talk about two different perspectives on that. When you talk about it from the standpoint of an employee who's working in a company year after year, generally speaking, most of those employees go to work and they do the job and then they go home and they're not doing the job at home. Right. So, you know, if you're somebody who's doing data entry in a classified environment, you go to work, you do your data entry, you go home. You don't, you know, spend your time at home talking about that latest data that you entered. No, it's like, oh, let's take the kids to the pool. Okay, great.
Right.
So you have this separate life. And so that's pretty easy to segment. But now you talk about people that are more like you and I, people that are, you know, doing more of the consultative sort of thing. They're going between companies. They're interacting a lot with a lot of people. They're going to conferences. They're expressing information because they have to in order to be effective at sales and marketing and so forth. And now you're in a different group of people, or, you know, a medical doctor who's, you know, going to medical conferences and wants to tell people the greatest, bestest things to do and make sure that he cares for their patient as well as possible, but is also working on research and reveals some information about the research. So that set of people, it's different for, and it's different because of the nature of what they do. And then the other thing about consultants, you know, you go company to company to company to company to company. So it's not like you only have to keep track of one thing. You're there to bring ideas and to understand things and help them address their challenges. And how do you do that without using the knowledge from where you were? Right. And so you use the knowledge in California. You're certainly allowed to use the knowledge, but then defining what it is you're not allowed to tell them about. Right. So, you know, somebody says, oh, well, we do backups this way. Well, that's a great way to do backups. You go to the next company. Are you supposed to say, no, I can't tell you how to do backups, but I know there are 15 different ways. I can only tell you 14 of them.
Right.
Oh, no, that cannot happen. Right. It can't work because people can't segment their mind like that, and because it reduces the value of the expertise that these people carry between the places. So it's a legitimate trade secret is perhaps my company does it this way, not the way, but the fact that my company does it that way.
Right. And yeah, this comes out of one of my core points on security about advising, which is that you got to be really careful about what you really think is important to protect. You know, because we cast this, you know, typically we say, well, everything. I don't want anybody to get anything. It's like, well, okay, then shut your doors and go out of business now. And when you really, really net it out, you know, what is your secret sauce? What is your intellectual property? What is your trade secret? Well, and there are processes to do that. You can define it very specifically and defend that as opposed to trying to defend everything and losing the utility of all of it.
Right. We talk about this a fair amount, but confidentiality is not necessarily the issue here, right? The confidentiality of what method you use to protect your computer system has nothing to do with the confidentiality of the method or its use in the computer system. It has to do with somebody who wants to break into that computer system who knows what your defenses are, is at an advantage. So, for example, in the classified realm, you know, I used to have, you know, control over, for one reason or another, systems that contain classified information. And they were using whatever operating system they were using. Suppose it was Windows 2.11. Who knows? Whatever. So sure. They're using Windows 2.11, and there are known vulnerabilities in Windows 2.11 at that time, and as there probably still are today. I don't think they've all been fixed. And so it's not classified that those vulnerabilities exist in Windows 2.11. It's, in fact, not classified that Windows 2.11 is being used in a classified environment. What's classified is that Windows 2.11 used in that classified environment has that vulnerability.
Right.
So, it's not like you can't figure it out.
Yeah.
Right. But I'm still not allowed to tell you.
Right. Well, you know, a lot of those conversations, you know, you and I know so many people who have had classifications and all of us have seen it in the movies, right? You can talk around the space and you can see the shape of what you're not saying. Which tells, you know, it's the whole elephant under a sheet thing. It's like, you know, there's no elephant there. It's like, I see a sheet-shaped elephant, you know, an elephant-shaped sheet. I'm guessing there's an elephant there.
Yeah, well, but so, you know, if that's classified, then I don't have to shoot you. You know, but what I am required to say is I can't confirm or deny that whether there's an elephant under that sheet.
That's right.
So that's the official line. So, yep. So Chris, I cannot confirm or deny anything, I guess, at this point.
That's right. I'm not even sure we're here.
On Tuesday, August 1st, join our free monthly advisory session at 9 a.m. Pacific time. For more details or to sign up, follow the link on thecybershow.co.
We're talking to Maria, who is one of the early women in the cyber world. She's had an amazing career starting as a programmer, and well, let's see where she goes from there.
So I got a good reputation from doing that. Our city's won some pretty prestigious awards at some of the major sort of industry awards that are handed out.
But besides that, you became fantastically wealthy, right?
I wish, you know.
All right, just say all right.
I became wealthy at heart.
Exactly. There's more rewards in life than cash, but you know, what is it? There's an old saying, don't applaud, just throw money. So let's talk about the next phase of this. Had to do with, remember the motorcycle gangs and the communications surveillance?
Oh, that was a good one too. Yeah.
Yeah. So, tell us that.
Okay. So there's another city just north of there, about 100 miles north of there, that the city itself loved to do this event. It was America's largest, the second largest, the first one is down in Waco, but the second largest motorcycle rally in the country. And it brings the city a lot of money, and it's a big haven for motorcycle gangs. And the city had stopped doing this because at the previous one, there was an incident that involved shootings and a murder or two. So the local businesses really relied on this event. And so the police department wanted to find a way to still have it. And so again, we took this as a challenge and again designed a system, a video surveillance system that actually monitored the event on multiple levels. It was the it was really the first time we layered technology. It wasn't just cameras. It was cameras, social media, mobility. In other words, knowing and tracking where every officer was, and actually bringing all that back into two command centers at each end of the event. Now that town is probably a town of it's a city of probably, I want to say like 60,000 people, but on the day of that event, each day it increased by at least 150,000 people, and most of them are from our motorcycle gang. So you got the Hells Angels and who knows, you know, the Bloods.
And I'm not sure if we can say Hell's Angels on the air, but but I'll check it out with the legal guys. But go on.
Oh, okay. Well, they're motorcycle gangs. So anyway.
Oh, no, it's not the name of the gang. It's just a matter, you know, we can't use the seven dirty words, but I'm not sure whether all right. So but let's talk about what happened with that technology and then what caused that to no longer happen.
So it was great. So we did two command centers. The main command center was just wall-to-wall monitors everywhere, monitoring every single camera. There was a police officer on every single camera. The ATF, the FBI, and the DEA were all in there. We had facial recognition going, license plate recognition going. They were looking for criminals, you know, obviously, that go to these events. And we also were monitoring what we called the social climate of the event. In other words, you know, social media was just starting to pop up at that time. And we already knew that the habit of people was, instead of calling 911 when something happened, first everybody would reach for their cell phone, right? And start recording it and then posting it on social media. So we had several social media. We had two in particular social media apps that we integrated and layered on top of each other to show us information in real time about the sentiment of the event. And so all this was being fed back into the police headquarters. And then again, at another site that was close to the event. And the event went off that year without a hitch. There were a couple of little skirmishes, but they were immediately squashed because of the quick response, right?
Yeah, because so it becomes interdiction when you can detect what's happening before it gets over a threshold and can go in. The police show up just as the fight's starting and break it up.
Yep.
So that was fantastic. And why don't we do that now? What happened? Yeah, no, I'm talking about the lawsuit.
Oh, the lawsuit. Oh, well, why doesn't that happen now? I think because a lot of that technology was just coming into fruition. We were able to use it at that point in time and get maximum benefit out of it. But as people started realizing that they were giving up all kinds of information through their social media, this and that, and these applications could, scrape these platforms for information and then feed them across, certain legal teams formed against these companies and shut them down pretty quick. So happened.
Unlike China, where they can continue to do that successfully based on our advancement, your advancement.
Yeah.
We now can't do that anymore. So we just have to have more shootings. All right. Well, interesting. All right. So let's just, there you go, Chris, the answer to your question.
Right. Information fusion. Yeah. And the parallels, again, you know, on a daily basis, you know, I'm talking about software bill of materials and SBOMs and everything else. And, you know, what interests me is the intersection. You know, that information plus. You know, so and
the thing that impresses me here is we always talk about the police being behind the curve in technology and all this stuff. Here, you know, this is a little teeny private company. They're way ahead of the curve in technology. They're there with the police and all the different agencies. They've solved the problem, really. Interdiction, not pre-crime, not, you know, arresting people that shouldn't be arrested, just getting in there just as the fight starts and stopping it from starting. This is sort of the ideal accomplishment. And
right,
you know, can't do it, sorry.
Well, you know, think about the beat cop, the cop on the street, you know, the stereotype of, you know, of the person who has the feel, knows what's going on, you know, can, you know, actually intervene in real time and make things right. You know, that's what we're looking to achieve. Not a depersonization of law enforcement and social structure, but just allowing, if we're going to have, you know, law enforcement officers, it'd be nice if they would actually understand the situation before they got there.
Right. It's a concept that's been there, and the military certainly has, you know, used it to advantage, right? This, you know, I don't remember what they call it. It's not situation awareness. It's now something else. I talk about situation anticipation and constraint, right? It's a wonderful thing to have, but there's this trade-off with privacy, with all the other, you know, once you understand this, the bad guys can use it too. And of course, oppressive societies can use it. So what is the way to get that balance? We haven't figured this out yet, but if we can figure out that balance, you know, we can do a great deal. In the United States, I don't remember the number of shootings, actually the number of shootings of not just shootings, mass shootings that we've had this year. It just went up like yesterday. I think it goes up most every day. If we could just get this figured out to where we could stop that stuff, it would be so much better for so many people's lives. But we just seem to be unable to handle it.
Well, I think we have the means of solving this. I think we, you know, haven't gotten there yet. You know, but the means is open debate, right? You know, because, you know, it's a really simple, you know, this is, you know, all of human history, but this has been tried and debated. There's force. We'll force everyone to be good. We'll do certain things. You know, the approach we have in this world, you know, and in this country and most of the entire world these days, at least in theory, is to have argument. We're going to debate it out. We're going to try things. You know, privacy issues, you know, associated, you know, the liberty issues and the freedom issues associated with law enforcement are what they are. And everything, even if well-intentioned, may or may not work out. So what we need to do is keep iterating the conversations and keep the arguments going.
So I think what happens is that, you know, there's always going to be people that will abuse any system because that's how people are. So what happens is we have a system that's working, that's good, that's really great, except somebody abuses it. When somebody abuses it, the reaction becomes more damaging than the actual consequence of what took place. So we overreact and we destroy that thing and we try and bounce back and forth, but we end up sort of gumming it all up. And I wish we could somehow control this this overreaction component and just have a more thoughtful discourse. But in the political system that we have, in the, you know, the marketplace of ideas where there's a lot to win or lose financially and personally and in terms of power by triggering people to be mad, we generate, you know, this excessive response so individuals can maintain money and power. And that, instead of benefiting the society, harms us all.
And I'd have to say our only defense, you know, is transparency, you know, and the fact that we can think about it and ponder it and talk about it and try to evolve the policies is the only hope. Because again, without that, in a truly authoritarian environment where you can't have these conversations and how dare you, you know, doubt the grand government communications network, you'll never, you've achieved all the problems in the first place and they're going to be there forever. So.
Well, yes, we have, but at the same time, the people really don't just yield to it, right? So that's just a system that becomes corrupt. So what happens, of course, is, you know, the wealthy and powerful exploit it and other people corrupt them. And so instead of having everybody screwed, you know, you only have certain
only people. The vast majority. Yeah, that's right.
Right. Oh, well, there's a benefit.
August 8th is our annual Go to Angel free-for-all. Any startup can pitch for free and get a 30-second slot on the Cyber Show. You have to fill out a G-Wiz before you can record, and you have to show up live online remote for the event in order to get on the radio show. To sign up, click on the link at thecybershow.co.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
We're talking here with Jennifer Bayuk. Jennifer was one of the first chief information security officers on Wall Street and has a long and storied career before and after that. Jennifer, it's great to see you. How you doing?
I'm well, Fred. How are you?
Alive and well and living in Pebble Beach. And I will probably cut that part out because at least the Pebble Beach part. Mm-hmm. So, Jennifer, I want to start with the beginning of your career. And, you know, nobody knows how you got started, and they don't know yet how you came to your current situation. But we'll get there. So start with the beginning. Tell me about, you know, where you went to school, what degree you got, how you ended up somehow getting into whatever it is you're into.
Okay. I went to Rutgers, and I was a philosophy major only because I didn't know what to major in. And I had even numbers of credits in the sciences, the social sciences, and the arts. So it turned out I could double major in philosophy and computer science and study artificial intelligence. So.
Right. All right. So you're in philosophy and computer science, artificial intelligence, which has all of a sudden become incredibly relevant today, right?
Yes, yes. And I really wanted a career in AI, and I did go to graduate school and study AI. And my first job was building expert systems. And unfortunately, I was at Bell Labs, at AT&T Bell Labs in 1990 when the phone network got attacked by a programmer who didn't know how to code a for loop. Okay. It was not a cyber attack.
Now, when you say attacked by it, it got deprecated by, it was a one bit error, right?
Well, that is the unintentional insider, as we call it in cybersecurity. But management at AT&T thought it may have been a hacker for about 2 hours. And they were scanning and scouring, and they didn't have the tools to detect hackers in phone systems. They had been threatened. The 2600 magazine was publishing, you know, all the secrets of how the signaling systems work, and people could easily hack them. So after they found out it wasn't a hacker, they decided that they were going to put some money in cybersecurity. Well, they called it computer security back then. And so they took some people who were in expert systems and put them in the security group who up until now was doing things like, you know, ask yourself, you know, awareness activities and policy. So, and then they got a tiger team, you know, so it was kind of like a, will you go here? If not, you know, we'll probably just we won't give you anything more interesting to do where you are. So you should go. And people left. People in my group were like, security is such a dead end. They went out to a startup, you know. And I stayed because I was inert, probably. But I did apply artificial intelligence to the public switch phone network and developed something called Security Analysis of the Network Environment, SANE, that acronym.
And love it. Yeah. So now, just, you know, going backwards a little bit, because we talk about AI a fair amount. And obviously, it's a big thing today, which is the large language model AI and the neural network AI, as opposed to the expert systems and the various other versions of things called AI over time. So just if you could just give us a quick briefing on all of the different things and forms of things that they called AI over the years that they proclaimed was either the end of the world or the greatest boon to humanity that didn't turn out that way.
Well, yeah, they had all the algorithms when I was in graduate school. You know, I did a neural network, which is what they're using now for generative AI. They just didn't have the computing power to run any of them, and they didn't have enough data to make any of the output meaningful. The best thing in AI then was a generative AI named Eliza. Do you recall Eliza?
Absolutely. That was the psychiatrist who could say, aha, tell me more about whatever you just said and so forth.
Yes. And I firsthand witnessed secretaries in the office playing with Eliza for hours. You know, they really did think Eliza understood them. So it doesn't take much, right, for a neural network to come back. And
yeah, Eliza, of course, wasn't a neural network, right? It was more of an expert system. Actually, it was a recursive descent tree structure of some sort.
But yes, it was more than your forward chaining or back chaining expert system. It was more of a hybrid.
Or maybe less. Because the amount
anyway,
of data.
I never did look at the code, I admit. So don't.
Oh, yeah. No, very little code to do that. But before that, there were these things called production systems, right? In a production system, so that's all the firewalls typically are a production system, right? They have a set of rules executed one after the other, and the first rule that applies gets executed, and then it goes and tries again. And that's a typical, you know, trigger execute mechanism for production.
Yes, time-based, pattern-based, that's what we called it then. Yes, pattern changes over time. You keep looping in to see what the new patterns are. And that's what we did with the phone network. Intrusion detection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And before that, there were things like purr and puss done by John Andreas out of New Zealand. But these were matching of strings and slides, right? I don't remember what the P stands for, but something using strings and slides. You would find windows on things and try to do feedback based on those windows from external feedback and learn. So all this stuff we're hearing about now is the same old stuff, but this huge difference in the data available and the computing power.
The emergent properties of scale, right? You know, as you and Jennifer were talking about there, what we see now as, you know, many things like ChatGPT and as AI you can talk to and so forth is in large part due to our ability to realize how many zeros are really involved, right? You know, the complexity, we underestimate the complexity of things. Kurt Vonnegut, player piano, you know, the 70s and 80s, you know, as I recall, a lot of fear that, you know, computers and robots are about to, you know, change the world, replace us all. Skynet's going to come. And it doesn't for decades and decades and decades. Now, that doesn't mean, you know, it won't for good or bad. It might mean that the problem just is orders of magnitude more complicated than you thought. And I find it fascinating that it's taken this long to, you know, reasonably replicate a human being, you know, in a human to human way, you know, with these AIs we have these days. Because,
right. So one of the interesting things I've come to believe in my career is that there's a change in kind associated with a change in scale. Right. And simulation is the area where I came to conclude this. Right. Because, you know, we knew many years ago that simulation was going to get faster and faster and more data. And the question was, when are you going to get to the point where you can do enough simulation to reasonably anticipate and constrain the future? And, you know, it's getting better and better. And I think when I did the study, you know, 35 years ago, I said in 25 years, which is 10 years ago now, that the execution and performance and storage will be adequate to do that level of simulation. And it is. But it's a change in kind. When we started to do simulation of security, of attacks and defenses in networks, those simulations one at a time tells you, here's something that happened, here's something that happened, here's something that happened. When you do a million of them, you can then look at the patterns. You can vary parameters across a multidimensional space, look at the outputs, and you start to see curves that show up that are consistent that tell you that there's trade-offs, and those trade-offs happen at particular places. And all of a sudden, you can now start to do design, good design, that makes sense based on large-scale simulations of different designs and explore the space of design. So it's a change in kind, the ability to understand things in a different way that comes with that scale. And so that is, you know, one of the things that we're seeing with these large language models. You know, when they say large, they're not kidding. Right? It's like, yeah. I mean, one of the side effects is they're, you know, burning a lot of energy. And so I think that right now AI is moving towards a position where it's becoming one of the top energy users in the world. So at some point, you know, we're going to have to decide that we're willing to burn more coal for more AI. I mean, I'm against burning coal, you know, for generating, you know, cryptocurrency, which I think is just a waste piled on a waste. But But AI has at least some utility to it. So what's the trade-off between, you know, destroying the planet and getting the analytical capability to determine that we should stop destroying the planet?
Right. Well, yeah, emergent properties always fascinate me, right? You know, and it's, you know, emergent properties may be just an emergent property of statistics if you look at it this way, you know, because if you, as you're saying, if you do something millions and millions and millions of times, you can start regularly seeing a one in a million thing, you know, yeah. And if you hack on top of that, you know, another data set of the same complexity, and on top of that, and on top of that, then you start getting into the one in a million in one, and one in a million in another, and one in a million in another. How often do those combine in what ways? And I think we, you know, this is kind of where I've gotten to with intelligent life in the universe. I think this is a, you know, perhaps a good example, because I think almost everyone on Earth is suffering from the same misunderstanding of scale with that one. You know, that, you know, we look at our solar system and you have a lot of things that to me look like a one in a million. Like if you took a cloud of dust and made stars out of it and did it over and over and over and over and over and over and over again, you know, there's multiple things about ours that are extremely unlikely. The Grand Tack, look that one up. And without all of those, you don't get 3.5 billion stable years, you know, where you can have enough time to evolve us. And I think that's, you know, there's a great Scientific American article on just this, right? You know, that we look at the universe and we say it's a big universe. There must be other intelligent life in it. And the answer, I think, is yes, but it might be over the horizon. You know, it's extremely likely that there's none around any star that we can see from here. But we say if there's 100 billion and 100 billion stars and 100 billion galaxies, it's like that's still a finite number. You know, you take a couple million and one things and tie them all together, and you outrun that space.
Well, so this notion that we know the extent of the universe, this notion that the Big Bang is the beginning of the universe, is, I think, ridiculous, right?
Like, a lot of information space. Let's just take this. I think we can bound this one fairly well, given all that. You know, it's you know, in 10^24. Right. You know, 10^24 is generally the number of stars you can see from here. And it's generally, given the observable curvature of space, the -10^24 is the percentage of the universe that we can see. Right. And it, those numbers may be larger, but they can't be smaller.
You mean 10^-24.
Right. Yeah, that's right. 10^-24. You know, so in other words, you know, the observable universe is in the relative scale to at least the smallest possible size of the actual universe, compared with the size of a hydrogen atom to the observable universe. It's a tiny, 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 what we see is a tiny, 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 tiny fraction of the reality we live in. But we have tried to extrapolate things on top of it and say, well, there must be. On that star, as we can see from here, there must be.
So my observation about the Big Bang is multidimensional. One of them has to do with, there might, of course, been multiple Big Bangs, maybe an unlimited number of them. But there's also the question of time. You know, so, you know, all we can see in the totality of the experience of humanity is a very small sliver of the total time that even what we currently see as the known universe has existed. So there might have been all sorts of things before now, you know, that were, you know, life forms and so forth, and there's plenty of time left. We haven't run out yet.
And I'm trying to keep this into a cyberspace. You can do the same thing with different data sets. You can look at something and say, that's so huge, if something exists, it must be in it. And if you don't find it, you can say, well, therefore, it doesn't exist in this even huger data set. It's like, yeah, right, that's, yeah. Some things are just very rare. Lots of
right, things. Right, just because you don't see it doesn't mean it can't happen, right?
Right.
Yeah, the other thing is, you know, the physics of digital information, because we have finite granularity in the digital systems, and as far as we understand it today in physics, the granularity of space is not finite, but infinitesimal, right? Which means that it's a different order of infinity having to do with the possible states, the continuous states, as opposed to the number of binary states of a digital system. So we're just getting started. All right.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies.
Next week on The Cyber Show, Bill and Fred end up in violent agreement. John gets sexual orientation thrown out of the clearance process. Maria can make it anywhere, and she proves it. Jennifer gets power and data from AI. More fraud, spies, and lies, and a pitch you will not believe. Or will you? Only on The Cyber Show. See you next week.
A good time at Bow. A good time at Bow. A string beating man and a fiddler for a band. A good time at Bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.